I am Nicholas Bornois of Capital Link, and I would like to welcome you to today's podcast in the series Riding the Waves of a Lifetime. This particular podcast series gives us the opportunity to discuss with maritime industry leaders around the world who share with us life and career experiences, as well as their insight on the industry's direction, opportunities, and challenges. I would like to thank Heidmar, the original pool manager in the tanker space, committed to innovation, performance, and transparency, for sponsoring today's podcast. Today, we have the opportunity to discuss with one of the most fascinating personalities in global shipping, Bob Burke, the CEO of Ridgebury Tankers. Raised in a shipping family, Bob's subsequent education and professional life have been entirely dedicated to the maritime industry. A U.S. Merchant Marine Academy graduate, Bob served as ships officer for 3 years aboard tankers. So how fitting that he's in the tanker space. Coming aboard in 1983, Bob has been involved since with every aspect of the business, from operations to finance to management and to ownership. For more than 30 years, Bob has been a managing director and head of shipping at GE Capital, a partner and managing director in Great Circle Capital, and an investor and CEO in Kembulk Tankers. And in 2013, together with other partners who had been working together for the previous 15 years, they established Ridgebury Tankers, which today remains a privately owned company owned by management, and Riverstone, a private equity firm. Starting from scratch, in their first year, they acquired 15 high-quality ships in 9 transactions in 8 countries, while building a first-class organization and operating platform. Today, Ridgebury Tankers boasts a fleet of 27 tankers, including 10 Suezmaxes, 13 MRs, and 4 VLCCs. As indicated on Ridgebury's corporate profile, Bob and his team are known for their quest to create value, not just to acquire assets. I have had the pleasure and privilege to know Bob for quite some time and work with him, and I always appreciate his friendship and support. And I have to say that one of the many things that I enjoy about Bob is his strong opinions on the industry and his direction. So I really look forward to our discussion with him. Our discussion is going to have a brief look down memory lane, highlighting Bob's remarkable career, and then we're going to focus on the present and the outlook, both for tankers and the broader industry. And I would ask now Bob to join us so we can start our discussion. So Bob, here you are.
Here I am.
Delighted to have you on.
Thank you for allowing me to have the screen off while you said nice things about me. I didn't have to be too embarrassed. Thank you.
Well, they were very factual and very true. So, you know. So starting our discussion, Bob, as I mentioned in my introduction, you come from a shipping family. So I guess your passion for shipping is well expected. Still, it would be interesting to know more about the background and what led to your maritime career.
First of all, thank you for the opportunity for having this podcast, and thanks for everyone's time for listening in. My family background is shipping, but it's domestic tugboat and barge. If you look over my shoulders at that picture of a tugboat, I think that's my great, great grandfather's. I think it's 2 greats, maybe 3. But my father was in the tug and barge business and the repair side of the business the last 40 years he worked. He worked till he was almost 85. And my mother's father went to sea for 20 years on Liberty ships. So some both sides of the family, I grew up in the water. It's, you know, all I really learned about. So when it came time for school, I applied to 2 schools, Kings Point and the New York State Academy, Fort Schuyler. And that was it. It's the only thing I wanted to do. So I was one of those lucky people who knew what he wanted to do early on. I think part of it was the only thing that I heard about. So it was, it's what I wanted.
That's great.
Yeah.
Over the last 30 years, as I mentioned, you've been involved with every aspect of the business, operations, finance, management, and ownership. So if we leave aside the establishment of Ridgebury Tankers, which clearly has been a major milestone, can you share with us what you consider a couple of major milestones in your career?
Yeah, I'd be pleased to. First of all, a lot of my comments are going to be directed towards people who are quite a bit younger than me, assuming that that's most of the folks who will listen in. And I look back at what I've done in my life, and as opposed to talking about some of the business successes, there are some of the key turning points that were really fundamental to get me where I am today. One of them was going to Kings Point. I applied there. I was the last one allowed into my class. It goes state by state, and New York's a very competitive state. That's where I lived. It's competitive because it's on the water, and everyone in New York knows about the school. So I actually got in the day after school started. So if that hadn't have happened, I wouldn't be here today. When I finished, I went to sea. And then the trick was to be able to go from working at sea, which is very lucrative right now, and it was even more so at the time, to getting a job behind a desk, you know, in a shipping company where you could actually add value and hopefully move up in the management ranks. Because my goal was to run a shipping company, whatever that meant. And I didn't know what it meant at the time. So, you know, the change was to be able to come ashore. I went back to school for a couple of years, learned about finance, and then got a job at a company called Marine Transport Lines. And that was instrumental to my development. Business successes. I have plenty of failures I can talk about also, but we tend to remember the winners. You know, I was given an award a couple of years ago, and the talk I gave was to young folks. And I said, a lot of people are getting awards today, and you see a description of their careers, and it mentions all their wins. But you need to understand that there were more losses than wins for anybody who has lived a full life and achieved any sort of success. But those are the two fundamental things that changed my life.
Wonderful. So now let's come to the establishment of Ridgebury Tankers, clearly a highlight of your career. Can you share with us some background on how this happened, how it developed?
Sure. I together with American Marine Advisors, Paul Leand, had purchased Kenbulk, and we sold that in 08, right before the crash, which like a lot of things in life, we made a lot of good decisions, but the timing was fortuitous. Or not, right? So this timing it was very good, and we made some money. And I went home and I told my wife. I said, "Well, we're going to sell." And she said, "I have two questions: how long are you going to be home for, and how long do the health benefits last?" And I said, "Don't you want to know if we made any money?" And she goes, "No, I just want to know how long you'll be home for." I said, "It won't be long. I'm going to get right back out there. You know, the market's good." Well, that was 08, and everything went, you know, hell in a handbasket, as they say. And it took me 5 years to raise money. It's humbling to go out and ask 100 and 150 people if they want to invest in tankers when you're basically a guy with a briefcase. But, you know, it was a slog. I kept at it. And, you know, what I learned is it's a numbers game. I had done this before, and I just kept on going to conferences, whether it was yours, Nicholas, or Marine Money or CMA or any of these things. I learned a whole bunch of stuff. I learned you need to stay out there. You need to keep relevant, which is hard when you don't have an organization behind you. I learned that the industry is very understanding and forgiving for people who are on the beach. I think folks like yourself or Marine Money or CMA don't charge you fees if you're unemployed for some period of time or on the beach, because they know that you know, you're out there trying to get something done. That wasn't a pitch, Nicholas. I mean, we had to pay something, but it was very understanding. And you know, it's a numbers game to ask a lot of people for, you know, for resources. And eventually I ran into one of the guys from Riverstone at a conference, and I had seen them three or four times already. And he said, "Why don't you come by and we'll talk about things?" And I did. And they said they put up $200 million. And I had been at it so long, I almost missed the cue. And then they did. And I called up a couple of old partners, and Hugh Crooks and I were, you know, off to the races and buying assets. So that's the story there. It was a long time. 5 years is a long time to hear no. You know,
Bob, quite a story. And you know, here I would like to highlight, to focus on your ability to go from a dream to reality.
And that's maybe I was asking the wrong people for 4 years and 11 months, right?
But you know, there you are.
You can always look at it that way.
I always look at the right way, that the glass is half full always.
I only had to ask one guy. I was asking the wrong guy for too long. So the market was right. The market was good, and that was it.
We talked before about major successes. We don't need to talk about failures, but let's talk about challenges. So would you like to share a couple of major challenges that you had and how you overcame them?
Well, the aforementioned fundraising has always and still remains to be a challenge because, you know, I don't have hundreds of millions of dollars to buy ships. And it was a challenge to develop a skill base with the goal in mind to run a shipping organization. When you start on working on a ship at sea and you want to get to, you know, the CEO desk, it's not impossible. If you look around, Lois at International Seaways and Gary at Eagle Bulk, they both went to the same school that I did, and they developed a you know, a skill base that enabled them to run an organization. And you know, you mentioned my background, and you know, it's always the question: are you a jack of all trades and a master of none? But you know, that development of the skill base takes some foresight and some consideration as you go through your life process to see the next step and to see what pieces have to fit together. But major career challenges, I've made bad investments. Nothing that really knocked me out of the park. You know, I tend to hedge my bets somewhat and not put everything in one basket. But the actual progression from start to finish, you know, to where I started from to where I want to be, was an ongoing challenge.
Wonderful. So, and Bob, it's very interesting, not only that you had the education going to the right school, but you also served on the ships. So you really had quite some preparation in terms of the business that you ended up in.
Yeah, it gives me a particular, I don't know if it's an advantage, but certainly when you're talking to a private equity investor and he's behind a desk, he's never seen a ship, and he's maybe talking to another CEO who has never been behind a ship. And I can say to them that I've worked on ships. I spent so many years on a tanker. I know what they look like. It was 30 odd years ago, but they haven't changed that much. And I can relate to it. When I talk to our engineers, I know what they're talking about. When I talk to our ops guy, I know what's going on. So it does give you the credibility, both with investors and also within your organization, to be able to talk to people, and they know that you probably have a handle on what's happening.
So would you like to elaborate a little bit on your commercial and technical operating strategy? I noticed that you work with a number of technical managers and pool operators. So maybe you'd like to share why you went this way?
Sure. Thanks for that question. So our theory is, or our belief is, that the shipping business can be broken down into different functions that have different levels of efficiency in different parts of the world, and also in different size organizations. So our mission is to take investors' money, invest it into this market, invest it efficiently, and then return it opportunistically when the market changes in their favor. So in order to do this, it doesn't behoove the investors to have Ridgeberry build a huge platform of people. What behooves the investors is that Ridgeberry has the functional flexibility to hire best in class on commercial and technical areas, and then have the flexibility to and the confidence to sell those assets when the time is right. So in order for us as a management team to be able to do that, we work closely with certain technical managers and commercial managers, and they'll differ depending upon the asset, and then sell the vessels when the market is hot and return the money to investors. And from a organizational point of view, if your organization is too big, it's very difficult as a runner, as a manager of a company, to sell all your assets when you have a lot of people, because it is very difficult to let people go. So it doesn't behoove us to build a big organization if that is indeed our philosophy. So we work with several different technical managers, and that will depend upon the ships that we buy. In general, if there's a good technical manager managing the ship when we buy it, in general, we'll keep them. There are a couple that we really like, some not as much. And that has to do with the people involved and the office that it's managed out of and so on. But of course, on tankers, it's expensive functionally and betting wise to change technical managers. On the commercial side, it's easier to change managers. There could be some friction, but not nearly as much. So on the commercial side, we look at the different pools for the different asset classes, and that decision is taken based upon how that particular asset fits into that pool. Could be the age, could be it's the point system, basically. And then some of the other finer points about in and out of the pool, if there's any friction involved there. So what we try to do is provide access to investors to as seamlessly and frictionlessly as possible have access to the tanker market, and then provide them the comfort that when the market, we bought at a good point, we agree on that going in, but then provide them the comfort based upon our track record that when the market is really good, we'll either sell the ships or time charter them out as fast as possible and return their capital plus a return. That's our basis. The different commercial and technical managers, there are a lot of good ones, and it really depends upon the circumstances. We don't have a in-house manager per se.
So, Bob, it's very interesting that, I mean, you're celebrating the 8th anniversary of Ridgebury Tankers, I think this year. And Ridgebury remains a privately held company. And so mm-hmm. you resisted the urge to take it public. Can you elaborate a little bit about the private versus public dilemma?
Yeah. There hasn't been a huge opportunity lately to go public, but there are always opportunities. I don't think it's a dilemma so much. It depends upon what kind of organization you want to be and what your investors want. For large investors in private equity companies, the large capital base, it's hard to get an exit. So sometimes the public structure is an exit. And the public companies, I think, are a trading platform as much as anything else for institutional investors who want quick exposure to the tanker market at that particular point in time. And they need the liquidity, either because they feel that they need it or by charter, they have to have a mark on their investment on a daily basis. And that works well for large public shipping companies. And they buy assets and hold them for a long period of time. And we offer a different opportunity for investors. What we offer to investors is this is the day, whatever day this is, to buy assets, because this is the dynamic of the market, and this is the future that we see over the next year, 2-3 years. So we offer to investors the opportunity to buy a discrete set of assets for a certain amount of time under a certain financial condition. So initially we were owned by Riverstone. Since we started 8 years ago, we've developed different silos, if you will, different investment groups that are distinct or discrete, with different capital structures and different investor groups. So what we offer to investors is, all right, you can invest in, if you need a mark, invest in one of the public companies, and that's great. If you want to control your investment and control your exit, you can invest with Ridgebury in these ships, and me and my partners will put up some money, and here's our investment strategy, here's our leverage strategy, and we will discuss when it's time to sell. And my belief is, since it's not my money, I put up a few percentage points, or my partners and I put up so many percentage points, that the investor should have a lot of say in when those assets are sold. So we avoid the Hotel California business. And that can happen in PE companies, and it can also happen in public companies if your stake is too big. So for us, it's a different type of investment and less of a dilemma than you might think.
Yeah, obviously, I think the way that you have your investment philosophy and operating structure, the privately held approach is better. So I read in your website, and of course, I know having known you personally, that you have a quest for value, not just buying assets, as you have mentioned. Can you tell us a bit about the company culture?
Sure.
It comes always from the top.
You love me softballs, Nicholas. I like this. The company value is that everyone has a boss, and our boss is the money, right? We report to the money, whoever that is. And if you want to keep your boss happy, you give him what he wants. And the money wants, number one, they want transparency. They want to know what's going on. So we talk to our investors on a very regular basis, and they get all the statements they want and the reporting they want. Number two, we give them their money back. We've always given them back their capital. And number three, we give them return on capital. All of our investments have had a positive return on capital. Of course, it's the same for the banks. If the equity is in the positive, then the banks have always been in the positive. So everything around here generates around what's good for the investment. Not what's good for the fees, not what's good for Bob and Hugh, what's good for the investment. And we really believe if we follow that philosophy, we follow that strategy, then all else will follow in our favor going forward. So a year or so ago, we sold four Vs very quickly. We had we only owned the ships for a year. We only owned them for a year. We had four more years of very good fees coming in, but the return was very positive. And you know, if we took a piece of paper out and said, what's better off for the management group, maybe it would have been hang on to them and tell the investor, look, you know, the market's gonna stay hot for a while. But we sold them at the peak. We're happy we did it. So that's the culture.
So Bob, thank you for all this insight. Now let's move to the industry section of our discussion. I know you have strong opinions on a lot of things, and
I can't talk about me anymore.
Glad you did.
Go ahead.
So let's talk not just only for tankers, but for the industry as a whole. Mm-hmm. Right now, one of the big debates is decarbonization. Everywhere we go, that is the topic of the day. What is the best way to get there? Who is going to regulate this? And how are we going to pay for it? We just had a very successful event yesterday at the in the context of the London International Shipping Week. That was, again, one of the major topics of discussion. So let me start with the first question on that. When it comes to regulations, to payment mechanisms, and so on, what is your take on this? I mean, it seems that we may end up having regional regulations, maybe multiple ways of paying for it. So what does this mean for you as a ship owner at the end of the day?
You know, regulations, a regulated industry always favors the incumbents. That's just in every industry, because you need the infrastructure to you know, stick with the regulations. You need the money to pay for them. You need a critical mass. So regulations are good for people who are already in the business. So from a selfish point of view, you know, it builds up a wall to new people. Yeah, people say, are you regulated too much in your industry? We carry a couple million barrels of oil in a ship. So it's kind of hard to say you're regulated too much, because if we don't follow the correct procedures and policies, it could be a big problem. And I remember 30 years ago when it was a race to the bottom and the ship was fixed. It wasn't fixed to the worst operator, but the worst operator set the clearing price for the best operator. So from an industry point of view, whether it's vettings or regulations, it helps the quality of the ship. The quality of the ship, you know, avoids more spills and mishaps, and is better for our industry as a whole. And I think you see over time, there have been less spills and mishaps over the past 30 years. Of course, unfortunately, when there's a spill, it's a big one, but there are less and less of them. So my view is, you know, whether the regulations are exactly right now, there should be more, it's in the right direction. And I think, you know, the owners have grown up with the rules and regulations, and it works quite well. Your second question was, who's to pay for the, who's to pay for this? Well, at the end of the day, the world pays for it, right? The consumer pays for it, industry pays for it. And I think the challenge with regulation is to make sure that the politics don't allocate those expenses in the wrong direction, where the unintended consequences don't achieve the objective. You know, if they come out and said all ships over 10 years old have to get scrapped tomorrow, then clearly there's not enough ships to be moving oil. So I think the challenge for our industry is to get the message across about how we function. Because I think the unfortunate thing is in our industry, and a lot of industries, is that, you know, the only time you're in the press is when it's negative. No one really thinks about tankers. So, you know, the risk is someone gets a bee in their bonnet about the tanker industry and starts yelling and screaming they need regulation ABC, and it doesn't make any sense for us. So I think, you know, the efforts of the IMO and industry to get involved in the future of regulation and paying for these things, you know, is all positive. I think at the end of the day, personally, I think, you know, a carbon tax allocates the real expense of burning carbon, you know, throughout the value chain. I hate to use those buzzwords, but it's true. Of course, the problem with that, as I think Al Gore figured out, is that the public doesn't want to hear it. You know, the public doesn't want to hear the price of gasoline is $10 a gallon, because then they'll want to know why. So it's easier for the public to hear that, you know, industry is paying for it or the government's paying for it. But as you know, at the end of the day, we all pay for it. And I think a carbon tax is the most efficient.
You know, you have the debate, is it the ship owner paying for it? Is the cargo owner paying for it? Especially because for the long-term charters, it's the charter who really directs the way the ship trades. But anyway, I think that's...
And if the cost of transportation is too high, stuff stops moving, or less stuff moves, and trade stops, or, you know, slows down. If container ships stay at $200,000 a day, less stuff is going to move. So if the taxes become egregious, then the trade routes change. There's less arbitrage for the clean ships. You know, the differential between the Brent and the WTI is less meaningful if bunkers are $2,000 a ton and ships don't go as far and the industry shrinks, which, you know, if your goal is to reduce carbon, that's what happens.
Well, besides decarbonization and the uncertainty around regulations and so on, what other major challenges do you see that the industry is facing today? Is it the crewing? Is it technology? Is it geopolitics, trade flows?
Yes, of course. All of the above. But I think, you know, the usual problems that we talk about, crew, trade flows, you mentioned one other, they seem to trickle through and get absorbed by the industry over time. People figure it out. You know, more crewing schools are open. You know, it's a matter of cost of labor in different parts of the world. So I'm pretty confident that will sort itself out. I think geopolitical, the biggest geopolitical risk, I think, is not a change in geopolitics. It's something that might happen in the shipping industry that gives the public, you know, a sudden spotlight on our industry and drives a change that doesn't work for us. And like when double hulls, when the Exxon Valdez had an accident, the big scream was for double hulls, which worked out fine. But I think the real efficient solution was hydrostatic loading, you know, which is you only load the tanker to the level, to the waterline, give or take because of difference in specific gravity between oil and water. Put that aside for a second. If you overnight limited ships to loading hydrostatically, then the chances of a significant spill would disappear. Whereas, you know, double hulls took 20 years to implement. So that's an example of an event driving a change that may not have been the most efficient. You could always still have double hulls, you know, simultaneously, but it was it could have been more efficient and better. And that's a small issue. But I think that's probably the biggest risk.
Now, we have seen, especially now, that supply chain disruptions have elevated the profile of shipping and its significance to a much broader audience. Do you believe that shipping commands today the visibility that is commensurate to its significant function as a link in the global supply chain? I have the feeling that the broader public is now becoming more aware of shipping, but I'm not sure exactly what they think of shipping itself. And what can we do to improve the image of shipping?
Yeah, they only think about what they see on TV for 5 minutes when a ship gets stuck in the Suez or rates go to $200,000 a day in container ships and a box costs $20,000-$25,000 to send over from Asia. But I think it's like most industries. No one really gave any thought to the paper towel and the toilet paper industry until COVID happened. And then they wanted to know why there isn't more of it. I think it's the same thing for, you know, the pen industry. You know, if there's suddenly a shortage, the people will say, you know, we produce 95% of the writing instruments in the world. We deserve more attention. Well, that might be true, but people are interested in their daily lives. And I think the attention only goes to issues that disrupt people's daily lives. So as a consequence, since no one's really interested in ships and they don't see them, the only time we get any attention is when there's a problem. So I don't think any, you know, PR campaign is going to suddenly, you know, make people more interested in how crude oil moves or how containers move. They'll only be interested when it's bad news. So, you know, I think the public image of shipping is going to be, you know, romanticism of 200 years ago, and that's about it. Cynical, huh?
Well, it is realistic, though. I mean, you have a very good point. I think when it comes to shipping, a lot of people really, as you correctly pointed out, they romanticize it, thinking of these big legends of the industry. But when they come to today, I'm not sure exactly what they're thinking of the industry. And
when I tell someone I work in shipping, they go, "Oh, are you with like UPS or FedEx?" Now people are cognizant of containers because of the publicity and the prices and the buildup in California and the Suez Canal issue. But generally not. No one had any idea that these ships hold 20,000 boxes until a year ago. And then you put it into numbers about how far that stretches, their mind gets boggled.
It is also very interesting that decisions affecting the industry are not just taken by the industry organizations, but also by political organizations that are under pressure from their electorate, from a wider audience, mm-hmm. that may care about decarbonization, but not necessarily about shipping. So things that may be ultimately applied on shipping may not be pertinent. Anyway, that's I think this is a discussion we have all the time. I don't know how it will pan out. But let's move to the next topic, company size.
Company size, all right.
So shipping has been a fragmented industry. We have seen at the same time a move towards creating bigger companies, both in the public and the private markets. But at the end of the day, when you speak even to the smaller owners, they are, you know, very strong supporters of their independence and of their capacity to be efficient and effective. So are we likely to see more consolidation? Do we need that consolidation?
Yeah, I think the size of the owners is almost irrelevant. I mean, you see an industry with five owners on the container side. You know, until there was a real squeeze, they were still beating each other's brains out. You saw it in the airlines. Same thing. I think the efficiencies are driven through tactical management consolidation. And now they manage 500-600 ships, 1,000 ships. And that's, I mean, they're not going to squeeze any more efficiencies out after that. And also, you know, on the commercial side. But I still don't think one commercial operator, I mean, on the clean side, there are a handful of commercial operators that manage close to 100 ships. And if I look at the results, it's like looking at one mutual fund versus the other over time. I mean, they're all good, but there's no one drives a price. We're all price takers in this business. So, you know, consolidation from the companies doesn't really improve. I mean, it helps bottom line profitability to a certain degree. And then like a lot of companies, you know, we're a small company. If we doubled in size, then our overhead wouldn't double, but suddenly we need other functions, an in-house lawyer, an HR person, all these other functions that we don't need now at the smallest size company that we are. So there are benefits on an overhead basis, but consolidation itself, I see as a long haul. There's no benefit between Frontline and Euronav having so many ships. I mean, the only benefit in the airline business that helped customers was frequent flyer miles. And as far as the only thing that helped, that was sticky, and we don't give those out. So, you know, it's hard to maintain customer loyalty.
So let's move now to the next topic, access to capital. What do you see, what do you make out of the changing landscape in finance? I mean, we have seen the number of commercial banks involved with shipping decreasing in number, also decreasing their portfolios. We see credit funds coming in, providing riskier capital at higher cost. We have leasing companies. So shipping is a capital intensive business. So where is the capital coming from?
In that topic, where is the capital coming from, has been a topic at Marine Money for as long and Capital Links for as long as I remember. Where's it going to come from? It's going to come from out there. You know, when the money is needed and the industry is willing to pay for it, it's going to show up. It always does. I mean, money flows like water. It's just a matter of pricing. you know, the banks have stepped out of the way. I think a lot of it because of pressure for ESG. Well, that's okay because, you know, the Chinese leasing companies are there. If they're not there, there are alternative sources of capital. There's the bond market. The money will be there. It always is because the industry will eventually, any industry will eventually pay what it needs to pay to get the money to provide the kind of return that's demanded for the risk. So I just for us, it's a matter of finding out where the money is today and to go there.
I have to tell you what I personally find fascinating is that when it comes to the commercial banks that are providing, if you want, more conservative capital at lower cost, they are decreasing their involvement. Whereas on the other hand, you have the credit funds providing riskier capital at higher cost. So maybe if the commercial banks could charge more, there could be a bigger bank involvement. Of course, we have other considerations like capital regulations, capital adequacy, and so on. But still, I think shipping used to be very dependent on bank finance. Now it seems to be less and less. And right now, shipping is in a very good cycle, at least for most of the sectors. So paying a little bit more for money is okay. But when shipping is in a soft market, then paying a higher cost for your capital is a problem.
The reason we come to your conferences, Nicholas, is because a lot of people with capital come to your conferences. And then the newest entrants providing capital to shipping often come to your conferences. So this is why we come there. That's why we support them. And if people are curious, then we can talk to them. We have the opportunity to do that. So, you know, I view you as providing more of a clearinghouse or an entree to, you know, capital and owners. But if capital is expensive for shipping, it can also be helpful for shipping because right now capital is so cheap that the old ships can hang around forever because the alternative use of capital isn't that exciting. You know, when LIBOR was 7 or 8 or 9, and there's a margin on top of that, and it's costing the banks, you know, 12% a year to have these ships hang around, they got rid of them. You know, if I'm looking at an older V right now and I can scrap it for $600 a ton or hold it in the hopes the market's going to take off, if my capital's costing me 10%, it's a different decision if my capital's costing me too. So, you know, I'm not afraid of more expensive capital as long as it's not just for me, it's for the, if it's for everybody. Of course, there's a point where it's get to be unsustainable, but, you know, within the certain range, it's not the end of the world.
Now, you are in the unique position of having worked also very successfully with a private equity fund. You established Ridgeway Tankers with the support of a private equity fund. They are remaining, they are a shareholder today. So can you tell us in general, not just for Riverstone, what do you see as the role and function of private equity in shipping? Can they be there as a capital provider for the long term?
Well, private equity is very opportunistic. And I think when they came in here, whatever it was, 8, 9, 10 years ago, there was a big push towards new builds, which is really difficult for PE to make 20% that they expect. So we took a different view on that. We said the best thing to buy is secondhand vessels and have operational leverage as opposed to financial leverage because you want to be able to survive until the market takes off. That doesn't answer your question. I think it's somewhat difficult. We talk to a lot of private equity investors. The challenge is, you know, ESG ships, dirty name, you know, we don't want anything to do with you. The other challenge is the energy sector itself used to be 10, 12% of the S&P. Now it's, I think, 2.5. So the energy sector used to be a must-have investment for funds. Now it's not so much. So now you have a much smaller piece of the pie and we're, you know, a subsector of that smaller piece. And a lot of the people who invested in it have gotten burned. So it's an uphill battle, I mean, for sure. But if you have the right deal, you know, it's out there.
That's true. So now let's come to the tanker sector. I mean, that's the sector you're operating in. Dry bulk and containers have a field day today. Everybody expects tankers to be the next performer. What is your expectation for the rebound of the tanker market and what can be the drivers behind it?
My expectation was last week.
Where we played them.
We sold a lot last year and then we bought a bunch back lately. In the past, since the first of the year, we bought 4 Vs, 3 Suezes, and 8 MRs. So we put a lot of chips on the table. and it would put our money where our mouth is. And we thought Q4, we would be back to where we want to be. And it always seems to be getting halfway there. So I don't have an answer for you, Nicholas, but we, you know, we bellied up to the bar and put our credit card down. So, I mean, we have low leverage and we have good assets. So, you know, we can be patient, but it's starting to stretch our nerves.
But apparently you believe now it's a good time to invest in tankers.
It's always a good time to invest in tankers. Yeah. You know, we do. It's a strange dynamic with the asset prices still very strong and the rates so low. And even the older assets are valuable because of the scrap value and the anticipation that the market may just pop. So, you know, everyone plays that optionality. That's why we're here. We're not here to make 6% of our money. We're here for when the market takes off. And in order to do that, you know, assets have been sticky in their price because everyone sees the demand at some point. And that's what we're playing for.
So last question before we move to the closing of our discussion. Mm-hmm. All this drive towards a greener economy, what does it mean eventually for demand for oil and products? Are we likely to see less over time? What is likely to be the impact in the tanker market? Of course, nothing is happening tomorrow. These things have a long way before they happen, but what is the direction?
Well, the direction, the whole world is trying to get green, at least the Western world, which has only 20% of the people who have a bunch of money and the other 80% that's developing, they just want to grow. They want basic things in life. So that whole sector of the world will continue to consume huge amounts of energy just to keep up, catch up with us. You know, I'm sure you know that the output in the U.S. is slower to decline in carbon and other parts of the world have increased. And that's a function of where we are in our development. But to answer your question, you know, the demand for energy is huge. And it jumps in people's face when they see that, you know, the oil demand only went down some, pick a number, 10%, something like that, when the world stopped last year. I've read 8%, 14%. It depends upon the bandwidth, the time that you use. And to go from where we are today to zero, you know, is some multiple of that decrease in activity. So the demand for energy, especially in the developing world, is huge. And even, how do I phrase this correctly? If you look at peak coal, everyone looks at coal as, you know, archaic. The peak consumption of coal was, I think, 2 years ago.
But it's been there.
Because oil overtook it in volume. But the demand for energy is so huge that the oil was just incremental energy that's added to the complex. And I read something recently, I saw some charts. The number for peak wood as a fuel, it stayed the same for the past 150 years in this country. So, you know, the unfortunate thing is, and I say unfortunate because we're all trying to make a more carbon-free world, is that demand for energy is so huge that as these new sources of energy come out, they just pile on top of the old source of energy that never goes away. So I think the challenge is, how do we replace oil? And I think that's going to be, you know, really, really difficult, especially in a world, you know, a NIMBY world, not my backyard. You know, don't build windmills here. And there's NIMBY, and there's also don't banana. Don't build anything near anything, never, anytime. So, you know, it makes that very difficult to change the energy complex when we have that out there. So I think what we do, buying 10-year-old ships, you know, I can't see the next 10 years for the market, but I can, I think with a reasonable amount of assurance, be comfortable for the fact that in an industry where the assets only last 20 years, that 10-year-old assets will still be viable, you know, for the next 10 years. And that's our bet as a business. And that's our strategy when we talk to new investors.
Well, absolutely. And you're very right. It will take a very long time to change the energy complex the way it is. By the way, I take a kick out of the idea that you may have a ship, a tanker burning non-fuel bunkers, but carrying fossil fuels as cargo.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, so moving to, we had a very interesting discussion as expected. Coming to the closing of our discussion, Bob, what's next on the agenda for you and maybe for Riggsberry Tankers?
If you extrapolate forward, you know, what I said, it's a continuation of working with private equity or family offices to develop individual investment vehicles to invest in a discrete group of assets. And we've gotten good at that. And we've gotten good at buying quickly and selling quickly and efficiently when the market's right. It's a niche or a niche, and we enjoy it and we make money at it.
Bob, if you allow me to throw one more question in, given exactly your modus operandi and your investment philosophy, have you ever considered doing something outside the tanker space?
I mean, it's passed through my head quickly, but the thing about the tanker space is, we know a lot of the answers in this office for most questions. And if we don't, we can get the answer with one phone call and understand that answer and be able to execute on it, as a informed operator. And my concern is, so I can go to an investor and say, we can do this for you and we can solve the problems. And we know if there's a problem, we'll have the answer or get it very quickly. I don't have that confidence in the container sector or in the dry sector. So I think if we were to go there, it would absolutely require bringing in somebody at a senior level who has a lot of depth in that area, and then merge our ability to raise money with that in-depth, in-house expertise.
So Bob, closing our discussion, I wanted to ask you, having built a successful career and reflecting back, would you have done anything differently? Would you give to a younger self some different advice in terms of what to do going forward?
I've thought about this. I think there are a couple of keys. There's just some advice to younger people. In an organization, you always want to be what I call a but for. And Jim Dowling from Jefferies told me this. And I said, Jim, what's a but for? He says, a but for at the end of the year, when they look at talking about bonuses, they go, what about that guy? Well, but for Nicholas, this deal wouldn't have happened. So we got to pay him a lot. But for Joe, that charter wouldn't have happened. We got to pay him a lot. So those are the guys who rise to the top, the guys who have added value to an organization. What you don't want to be is a waiting for, or I'll get back to you. So when your boss walks around and asks you a question, the answer can't be, oh, I'm waiting for, because waiting for is not an activity, or I'll get back to you. So those are two just strategies I've had over time. When you ask for advice from someone who's senior, try to listen. I didn't listen enough. I would often be so invested in my strategy or thought that I would say, yeah, but. Well, if someone says, yeah, but, then they're not actually listening to what you say. So it's a real discipline for me anyway, when someone tells me something I don't want to hear, or a different opinion, whether it's business or political or personal or religious, to actually absorb it. Because we all have our own thoughts, and they're pretty mostly pretty embedded. So that's what I would say. And the last thing is persistence. Opportunities are out there. I mean, they're right out the window, and the money's right out there too. I mean, you just have to go find it. My daughter said to me one time, she said, Daddy, you think you have all the power in the house, but you have all the money. And I said, no. I said, I have all my money. I said, there's plenty of money out there. I said, you just have to go find it. I don't want all the power. So get your own. It's a fine line between being persistent and banging your head against the wall endlessly, and listening to people along the way and taking everyone's thoughts on board as you go through a process. Raising money for 5 years, I listened to a lot of people. I probably didn't listen to enough. There were some deals I had I thought really made sense, and the market, the money, told me it didn't, and I probably should have listened sooner. But it's always hard for someone who is headstrong to sit back and listen to somebody else's opinion. Because if you're headstrong, by definition, you're right. So it's really, goes against the grain to sit back and say, well, maybe I'm not. So that's what I would tell young folks to listen to.
Well, let me thank you very much. We had a long and very, very interesting, very insightful discussion. Bob, thank you very much for being with us. It's a privilege to have you on board. And again, it's been great working with you over the years. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Nicholas, and thank you to everyone at Capital Link. And I meant what I said before, you do an excellent job and provide an excellent service for folks like myself to get introduced to a lot of different types of capital in a lot of different parts of the world. I enjoy a relationship both on a professional and a personal basis, and everyone else in your organization. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye now.